Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
For those of you that don't know anything about this sector, I thought I would just give a little introduction to the relatively new and upcoming sector that is legal businesses on the stock market. But firstly, who are we and where do we fit within the legal sector? Many of you will have heard of Hogan Lovells, Slaughter & May, Clifford Chance, the well-known legal names. But like many other sectors, there are industries within the big industry of law itself. And we are a litigation business that operate within the subset of law that is dispute, contentious, the words litigation, all of those words that you will have heard. And in that respect, we work in a very highly specialised part of the legal industry. And it's a more challenging, specialised, and as a result, high margin and price inelastic to a degree industry. So who am I? I am a commercial CEO who started my career back in the late 80s. I'm that old. Running the Brands Hatch Leisure Group, which was a motorsport group that came to the market in the 90s and sold out to the Interpublic Group, an American advertising company, for 52 times or return on money in early 2000. I then left industry to go and run a private family office in order to have children, have a family, moving abroad for a decade. And then I wanted to do something more challenging, I came back to talk to one of my closest advisors, who was Ian Rosenblatt, who I had founded Rosenblatt's in 1989 with seed capital that I'd provided. Ian had always had very strong views about the need to commercialise the legal sector, and as I'll come on to explain in the course of the presentation, it's probably the last bastion of industry that hasn't modernised and is still operating in an incredibly turgid, traditional, lack of innovation. I mean, you name it, every word that you can think of. It is a very backward-looking industry. And many times I'm asked, why motorsport and then law? They are totally unrelated industries. How can you possibly run a law firm when you know nothing? You're not a lawyer. And I'm not only not a lawyer, I haven't come from the professional services background. So I haven't been in fund management. I haven't been an accountant. I haven't been a lawyer. So it's a different business model. One of the most interesting things to me when I joined Rosenblatt's is that even though it has this specialised area of law where we're able to charge to a certain extent retail pricing model, it was still a very uncommercial product, with the lawyers and the management, which was all legal management, very focused on the product. And when I ran Brands Hatch, everyone was very focused on the motor racing, the engineering regulations, Formula One, the politics, where actually the business is about selling tickets, burgers and T-shirts. And it's not about those awful burgers. It's not about, actually what's going on the track. So I took that business and I turned its focus outward to the client. And that's exactly what I want to do here and have done for Rosenblatt. And who knows, the rest of the industry might one day follow. So I remain, it's often heard or it's often written that I'm the first commercial CEO of a legal practice in this country. That is true, but there are other professional services background accountants who are running as CEOs. But they have the similar training, if you like, in that they were inured in law, which is a product that's ultimately operationally geared to time. They're selling an hour. And that is the limitation of the business model. So it's lucrative in the sense that it's recurring, and it often provides a steady income, and that's what you'll see of our competitors later on. But it is operationally geared, and therefore it needs a commercial approach to look at how you can pull away from that gearing. So Rosenblatt, exactly where do we sit and what is litigation? So our competitors, having mentioned some of those brand names, our actual competitors are Enyo, Stewart's Law, Signature Litigation. I suspect you haven't heard of them. Sometimes Mishcons are on our side. Most of the time, we are fighting a case. We are a protagonist-led. And this is a very important distinction when you hear about litigation. later, and we talk about litigation finance, some of you may be familiar with this if you've been investors in Burford. And that is that we have to make the case, we have to create the case, we throw the hand grenades at the other side. And therefore, on the other side, especially if we're going after an institution or a bank, you will often find a blue chip law firm like Slaughter & May, Herbert Smith, Mishcons, Pinsett Mason, and very often on the other side of our cases. And being defence-led litigation is very different. You just have to bat the balls away. So you already know what the argument is. You haven't made the case. So it's we are the Rottweilers. That's how I describe us. We are the Rottweilers of law. And it's very specialist. So that is what how we're different from other law firms. And now when you bring our commercial expertise, then that makes us even more different again. So we are strategically non-panel. We will never act for banks or for institutions or for brand name clients like Tesco's or anyone like that, so that we remain what's called conflict free. We can always go after them. We can always litigate against them. Strategically, there are some corporates that instruct many multiple law firms so that those law firms are conflicted and can't sue against them. And that's very common in our sector. We have a successful track record in litigation. I'd expect that, frankly. If we're specialists, we should know what we're doing. It's currently running at 84%. And I want to stress when I talk about success rates, because this confuses some people, there are two ways in now that you can litigate. And I'm going to come on to explain how that works. And one of them is that you can pay for your litigation as you're going along. Or the other now, since 2007, you can get your lawyers to do it at risk. And therefore, it's called an alternative billing arrangement. You don't need to pay the lawyer necessarily to go along. So our success rate is measured on those cases that we took on risk contingently, and therefore we had skin in the game. If we were to add in all the cases where we're paid, you'll get a slightly different result. I don't think it would be much lower, but obviously sometimes a client will want to litigate when we do not think their chances of success are good. But if they want to litigate, it is the client's prerogative. And if we're paid to do a job, we do that job. We do have a duty of care as lawyers. We can't take on cases we absolutely know they're not capable of being won under law. But apart from that, therefore, we will have cases. So our success rate is very much linked and always will be whenever you hear it quoted to our success on cases which we have taken on risk ourselves. So the growth strategy for us as a business, if we don't want to be operationally geared by time, is to find other ways to make money. When I joined 3 years ago, there were two things that I noticed hugely. The first was what I've mentioned, the backward focus, the focus on the product rather than the client, the tail wagging the dog. I am a client, I've been a client for 30 years, and we're dictating pricing. We're telling law firms, we're not going to pay you on the hour anymore. This is ridiculous. I'm sure many of you in this room have paid for contractual lawyers, residential lawyers, moving house, and you will now fix the fee so that you don't get a surprise at the end of the day. That has been client-led, dictated pricing policies placed on law firms. And many of them have seen their margins squeezed hugely. And when we later come on to look at our competitors, you will see that they're operating much lower margins than we are. So how did I move the pricing? I didn't change the price. I didn't change the hourly rate. I made the law firm more efficient. So if we know that the client's only going to pay, in our case, it'll be normally a commercial contract. We don't do low-level, low-price work. So if it's a commercial contract for an acquisition for a client or a placing agreement or an IPO, they'll want a fixed price, and we will work to the fixed price rather than doing as much work as we like. There wasn't a value placed by lawyers traditionally on their time. They didn't value it sufficiently. And then, so what I did was educate them, firstly, around valuing their time and ensuring that they're operating within that. And therefore, when you do that, you suddenly find you've got more time to sell, surprisingly. So that was the first thing I noticed. The second thing was that litigation finance, which has been around, and I'll explain a bit about it later on, had been around for a decade. We were unable to finance often our clients' cases. And there are two ways of financing a client's case. The first is that you just do the work for free, but then we still need to pay our staff. So we need to underwrite through working capital our ability to work for free. The other way is that clients have other costs when they litigate. They have counsel's fees, court fees, expert fees sometimes. And that needs hard cash. So we would introduce a litigation funder to our client, and just because we did not have the balance sheet gearing to underwrite the working capital or invest in the claim, we would see the upside of that investment go outside to the funder. So it made sense to me as a commercial animal to bring that funding margin in-house. There are complications around that, which I'll come on to later. So our growth strategy and our main reason for coming to market was to find the to raise the money necessary to support both the working capital requirement and the litigation investment requirements of the business. So a little bit about our financial results to date. We have only been on the market for a year. We're fairly small compared to all of the other law firms that you'll come across or other legal businesses, and I'll show you why later. Our revenues were up 18%. They're all organic. There was no M&A. That is the only double-digit organic growth in the sector. Our annualised revenue per fee earner at £400,000 is significantly ahead of our peers. So that's £400,000 per fee earner. That ranks us around 15th to 18th in the legal industry. Later on, I'll show you there are 10,000 law firms in the UK. So we rank somewhere between 15 and 18 alongside Herbert Smith, Pinsent's and Mishcon's in terms of revenue per fee earner. Our gross margins are higher than the industry average, which is 50%. We're running at 63%, which is typical of litigation product. Our adjusted EBITDA, and by adjusted, we're simply adjusting for IPO costs on our last year, are running at 34% margin. Now, our competitors are running somewhere between 9% and 19%, depending on their model. But no one is getting to our margins. We're targeting to remain at 35%. Obviously, if there is a strategic deal or acquisition that makes sense to do, that may take a hit. But personally, I believe this business is capable of delivering that year on year. Normalised net margin would be 20%. We had exceptional tax for non-allowable IPO costs this year. We have cash on the balance sheet of 13 million, an interim dividend we did of 2.8%. We'll do a progressive dividend, which I'll come on to a bit later, and our shares currently qualify for IHT relief. So that's a little bit about us financially. In terms of where does that come from, 76%, so employment up there and dispute resolution go together. Employment, we don't do people service contract, we do contentious team moves, breaches of restrictive covenants and another contentious work. So it's 76% of our revenues. Now, when we came to market, it was 60% only a year ago. Why has it gone up? We've seen a softening in the corporate market. I'm sure many of you are aware of that. Brexit has had an impact. We've got a delay in M&A. There's very few IPOs going on. But we have seen a rise in contentious work. That is fairly normal. So we have a sort of natural hedge to our business. In terms of the income statement, I'm not going to dwell too much because it'll be on our website anyway, but it was really just to drill down into some of the metrics that I've already given you there. I don't think there's anything particularly that I wanted to pull out further on there. Cash flow statement, similarly, we're still running fairly cash high because it takes time to onboard cases. It's not, so we had 8 months trading last year. And therefore, by the time we got to the year end, we only had 300,000 actually invested in cash in cases. So that will change considerably during 2019. We've got a strong balance sheet, debt-free, running a fairly low WIP. We've got 3 million in lockup and 2.3 million in debtors. We acquired the debtors of the partnership when we acquired this Rosenblatt, the first deal that we did. And I think what's most important really is our lockup. Again, as a metric, if you're looking at law firms and these businesses in this sector, you want to look at how long their WIP and then their debtors are locked up. Industry averages 140 to 190 days, depending on the size. It's appalling. Ours is running at, I think it's at 41 at the moment in total. Actual debtor days are 32. I don't think there's anyone else in the industry who's achieving that at all. And there's nothing clever to that. We're just chasing our debt and we're just billing people, not doing anything special, just doing our job. So the legal services market, for those of you that want some metrics, it's 35 billion, set to be 40 billion by 2021. It grows around 5% growth rate, 10,000 law firms in the UK, a deeply entrenched partnership structure of equity partners. So you go in, You put in your capital. Normally, you've borrowed it from a bank, a couple of hundred grand. You have a career where you might earn, if you're very good at the top end, you will earn top money. But most people are earning a normal, what we would call a normal salary as you go through your career. And then you come out at the end of it getting your capital account back, which you pay back to the bank. So in other words, you've made nothing except what you've been able to add to your pension, like any other employee of a business. So deeply entrenched, and in my opinion, not fit for purpose in the modern time. And I'll come on to our structure and what I think ours is, why ours is better. Interestingly, one of the metrics I love on this slide is that of the 10,000 law firms, 15 of them, FIT15, have 50% of the revenues of the industry. So that's the magic and silver circle as you know it. So that means that your average law firm size is 2 to 4 partners in the high street in Epping or Cheltenham or anywhere else. So a little bit about our peers on the market. And as you can see from the, if you look at the middle box there, the total fee earners are 47. We are probably one of the, well, we are the smallest on the market. And we rank, if you were to take our revenue in total terms, I think we're running at 134 in the top 500 in terms of the size, our size. So although we look very small here, we're not actually, compared to the law firms in the UK, not very small. You can see our metrics. The industry average across the listed our listed peers is 154,000 for the revenue per fee earner. So we're quite far ahead of that. And then the other column next to it, the fee earner to admin staff ratio, which is another important one when you're looking at these businesses, because they sweat assets. That's how they work, the other businesses. So you'll find usually it's 1-to-1 admin to fee earner, which is an appalling metric. We're running at 2.1. Some of the other businesses like Keystone, they're a technology platform, so they're running very different to that. Again, you will see their margins on the right-hand side and where they're coming in at. So once we scale, and if I can hold my margins, we'll be materially more profitable than them. In terms of the remuneration of the business, I mentioned that the traditional model is to be a partner and to earn normally a fixed basic and have a profit share, which often, and there's a misnomer around this, is often decided in the same way that bonuses are decided in any other business. So it's not really a profit share. So you get a cabal at the top, the sort of inner sanctum of the partnership, who decide what profit is available to the majority of the equity partners, and then they allocate it in the same way that other businesses would make bonus allocations. They are fully distributed models. All the cash goes out. There's no cash available for reinvestment, and you may argue, what reinvestment do we need? Fair enough. You do need, obviously, some technology investment today. But the main problem is it doesn't secure the future because you've cash distributed. And therefore, what will surprise you if you were to dig underneath the bonnet of many of these law firms is that they are in debt because there have been good years and bad years, but the salaries have remained the same, particularly after 2008. So when numbers started to drop in 2008, salaries remained the same. You ended up with a gap that was filled by debt. This is the only sector, having come in, and I do, in my family office days, I've run many other businesses from restaurants, hotels, manufacturing estates, medical billing companies, all sorts of different businesses. This is the only one where I've seen everything financed, from the VAT, quarterly VAT bill, to the PAYE bill. I mean, it's quite unbelievable, and it's prolific throughout the sector. So I will leave you to make up your own mind, but I think many of our listed peers may have come to the market because they had a debt gap that they needed to take care of. In terms of, therefore, how I see the future, and the remuneration is therefore key to that, is what I would consider to be normal if you've come from any other commercial sector. So I consider that corporate paper, be it public or private, is the best way to structure a business and to motivate your staff. The majority of lawyers are salaried staff. They are, the majority of fee earners are not capable of winning the big clients or the big deals or the big cases. You get a few key business developers, which we call rainmakers still, from the John Grisham novels, and they are capable of delivering businesses and clients, and Ian Rosenblatt is clearly one of ours, alongside a couple of others. But the rest of them are fee earners, and therefore I believe the business should be run commercially and centrally, and that they should be motivated accordingly and properly in the same way that you would do if you were running Brands Hatch or anywhere else. What also happens in a private equity partnership is that often you find, because you're a partner, you expect to have a say in the management of the business. So quite often there is things get stuck. Decisions aren't made. And this is quite important when we come on to how we're going to benefit from litigation funding. So we ensure that our fee owners have a salary, and then they have a dividend, they have equity, they have a dividend on that equity. So in that respect, they're sitting shoulder to shoulder with our investors. And then bonuses are paid for exceptional performance from an exceptional bonus pool that is self-funding from our results. Looking at our structure versus the equity partner model, it was traditional to sweat your assets. You needed a lot of people underneath for the rainmakers on the golf course to send all the instructions back to base and have everything churning. So then that's why you've got images and stories of, and they go in the press sometimes, of, you know, associates at the Clifford Chance. They even have bedrooms in these buildings. You have in-house bedrooms, gyms, kitchens, the works, I mean, and a restaurant. And they are literally working 24 hours. We are next to Lovell's, and it's working 24/7. It's going all the time. We have an hourglass model. So we're partner-led. These are our business developers. They're bringing in the cases or the clients. We have obviously core that is basically our future partner material coming through, but we run a big contracted core. So as and when we need to, we expand with those that we get on the market. Now, obviously, again, we've seen life change a lot the last, 20 years. People don't want to sweat in an office. There's flexible working arrangements. Women want to work part-time or part of the year. There's some real good talent out there, and we take advantage of that. We have our own pool, and it's growing all of the time, because every time I go and do any speaking engagement, particularly in our sector, more and more and more sign up to be a part of that. So we have no problem getting the supply of contracted lawyers. And what that does is it gives us a natural way of dealing with a downturn in income if we have a recession. And many law firms, as we discovered in 2008, they can't react fast enough because obviously their main overhead is both rent and people. So it gives us an ability to be very aggressive with how we flex if we need to. So it makes us safer. I wanted to explain a little bit about how litigation finance came about. What is it? What is it, and why did it happen? So I'm going to give you an example of a corporate. It could be the same if it was an individual. A corporate has a potential piece of litigation that it is looking at having to fight. That means immediately it's got a contingent liability on its books. It doesn't have any idea of what the total scale of those costs are going to be. It's uncertain. They've got a claim, which they may or may not win. And when they win that claim will not be recognized as an asset because it will be treated as an exceptional item by their investors. But their costs of fighting any such litigation will be sunk into the business, and they might have missed their numbers. So this is this very uncertain way of treating litigation for corporates created an idea for Burford, who were the first ones to do it, that you could go to a corporate and say, not only will we offer to fund your litigation so you don't have the contingent liability, but we will also sometimes give you value for your claim today. So you can either sell out your claim or you can partially sell out your claim. So it's a very flexible way for a corporate of dealing with potential litigation, which is not your core business. So in our case, because we're a law firm already, the great thing about our business model compared to Burford or Manolete or any of the other pure litigation funders, LCM, if you've seen them on the market, is that we have an ongoing business. So all of the time we're selling law underneath. And then we have cases come along that enable us to invest in them differently. So at the moment we've got 5 million allocated of our 13, which will be fully vested, I expect, by Q1 2020. And that enables us to take on cases that might not otherwise get fought and do them at risk. I mentioned earlier that we're non-conflict and that other firms are conflicted. So we often get case referral because of conflict, which is very important. We also need to put in place, and this is my commercial hat going back on, we need to put in place various KPIs that ensure that we don't get out of kilter, because it's very easy for a litigation house like us to end up doing too much work at risk. So then you're not billing. So you must have a natural balance between ongoing pay-as-you-go work and that you take on risk, even though the work you take on risk might actually going to reward you tens and tens of millions. So it's really important to keep those balances. I do it in two ways. One is that we will not allocate more than 25% of revenues to free time. So 5 million is our current cap. We're sitting at about 2.3 million of that. So we always have to be charging for the rest of our revenue. And 25% of our net assets is our current cash limit on what we would allocate ourselves. So if we're going to be limited on what we're allocating, does that mean we're limited on how we grow and how many cases we can take on? Well, the answer to that is no. You've got the hourglass model, so we can take on more people. Can we take on more capital? Well, there's myriad of ways of doing that. One of them is to go back to the litigation funding community, which is enormous, and just borrow the money. Another way is to sell part of the cases ongoing. And what that will enable us to do over time is to create another revenue stream for the business. And that is what we are currently doing. So this is a selection of our current cases that were taken on risk. Neptune, we had on at the time of the float. It is a carbon credit fraud against a major bank acting for Her Majesty's government. There was no money invested by us. There was a litigation funder on it, but we did not have litigation finance at the time. Shango is a, and that judgment is due actually, it's actually very overdue. There's supposed to be 3 months after the case is closed that we get judgment. In this case, it's running well over time. Shango is a case we onboarded just after the float when another law firm was conflicted and they passed it on to us. It's a case against a major multinational out of jurisdictions, come out of another continent. We have invested, or we've allocated 2 million of WIP. We're only at about 500,000 at the moment. We've committed 2 million of cash into the case, but we have de-risked 1 million of that by selling off 1 million of the case already in order to flex our risk profile. A major case against a international a phone company. Again, it's come out of jurisdiction and it's come because of a conflict in another firm. It's still in the process of being onboarded. It's extremely complicated. The bigger these are, the more complex they are. There's a lot of legal assessment going on in terms of what we would commit to it. There's a 5 million requirement at least. In fact, I was just told yesterday that's probably nearer 10. We would never do more than 50% of any of cash case. That's our third KPI, our third measure of how we stay safe as a business. So we would not be exposed to more than 50% of the cash requirement on a case. A shareholder dispute, we're a major investment bank, well-known one to all of you. Primus Pilus is a class action, a whistleblower in the insurance industry. Again, we partner with another law firm that does class action and works on a technology platform. We do the complicated, clever bit at the High Court, and we're currently in the process of reviewing that. Byzantium is an international family who had a freezing order across their assets a few years ago by an international bank that caused the whole group to collapse. And we're in the process of evaluating with counsel whether we would take that on. So these matters are known in the industry as CFAs or DBAs. CFA is a conditional fee arrangement, which is where you put your time in for free and you get double your money back. And a damages-based agreement is where you put your time in for free and possibly cash, but you're allowed under the DBA regulations to take up to 50% of the award. You can never take more than 50% of the award to protect the claimant and make sure that it was worth them going to court. So just whizzing through the last couple of slides, our dividend policy is progressive. We're looking to pay half yearly dividend and then exceptionals when we get exceptional returns from litigation finance. In terms of our M&A strategy, this is not core reason for going to market. I do think it's a sector in considerable consolidation. I think there will be a lot of change. If we see the right opportunity and it's right for our business, we'll take it. But it is not the raison d'etre of our business model. We are predominantly about litigation, and therefore our outlook is to have continued strong organic growth from our dispute resolution practice and also to use the financing opportunities and the deal flow we think will come from international markets. So those of you familiar with Burford, they have got, I think it's 50 or 60%, 60% of their revenues coming from the US market. And then the other large markets are UK, Europe and Australia. We are targeting the Far East, the Middle East and Africa for our growth areas. And I think that we will see considerable expansion where litigation finance is not well known in those jurisdictions. And of course, many of their cases are heard in London due to the impartiality of our courts, would you believe it? And the speed. We're actually considered fast compared to other countries.
Cases are likely to be lumpy in the mm-hmm. settlement. How do you intend to tackle that particular issue?
Well, it's a very timely question, this, because for those of you that have been invested in Burford, there was a rather nasty broker's note issued recently that suggested that their numbers are not being calculated correctly. One of the reasons for that is because they had a bad couple of years, and that should be reflected, and it hasn't been in their numbers. One of the reasons it hasn't been reflected is because they've sold off a piece of their case, which we're already doing to start off with, to help them even out. But the bottom line here is that if we want to have the returns of those cases, we have to plan to have lumpy revenue from those. Where we're lucky is the core business will continue to be in a fairly even line, but the individual cases will drop through in difference, and that's why we're doing the biannual dividend and then special dividends. And obviously, we'll be using some of the returns to refund the litigation finance pool.
And how long do your cases typically last, and what percentage go to settlement rather
than... Yeah, this is hugely important, because, again, if you're a strict litigation funder, you'll be looking at a 4 to 5 year investment period. Quite often, we get cases towards the end of their cycle. So Shango, for instance, has been running for 5 years already, and it's in the last 2 years of its cycle. So for us, it's really difficult to say. We have some that are going to start from the beginning, Byzantium and, Byzantium has run 2 years. Primus Pilus is from the beginning, that will run 4 or 5 years. So the average is probably 2 to 3. And in my experience since I joined, it's been that. And how many settle? That's hard to answer, but it's the majority.
How do you, I mean, the existing partners in Rosenblatt who sold out to create the PLC will, I'm sure, be terribly happy having taken a lot of cash off, you know, taken a lot of capital value. But how do the cohort of kind of next generation partners feel about having these external shareholders in the business, like people like us, effectively sucking profits out of the business who have nothing to do with it?
Yeah.
And do you therefore have a risk of losing the best of your next cohort partners to go to other firms where they will be kind of proper partners rather than effectively just senior employees?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so one thing, to answer one question first, the equity partners in Rosenblatt, when we acquired it, were only two of them, Ian Rosenblatt and Tanya McLeod. The cash element of the transaction was 20 million, and that was used to pay down debt on the partnership because we had a debt-free transaction. There was no free float of cash in that. And therefore, Ian Rosenblatt has 21% now of the PLC, and he is tied in, so he has not had a capital event. In terms of the existing partnership, as I said, most partners and most fee earners are what we call processing lawyers, and they want security and a salary more than anything else. You've got to remember, lawyers are conservative by nature. So the rainmakers and the business developers, as you would get in any business, there are 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 key income drivers you need to motivate and structure differently. In our case, they are driven both by equity share options and a share and a percentage of future new revenues dropping through into their bonus pool from new client, new revenue. And that's what we do for the key. For the rest of the partnership underneath that, they've already done exceptionally well because Ian effectively opened up the equity allocation. They got, I think it was 5 or 6% of the equity was given away to the partnership. They were not existing equity partners. And so far, we have lost no partners during this process. In fact, we're the only law firm that came to market and didn't lose partners.
Thank you for one of the best professional services presentations that I've heard in 5 years. Three questions, but they're all in one. How long are you committed to be around with Rosenblatt? How much skin have you got in the game? What happens to me as a shareholder tomorrow morning if you get hit by the proverbial bus known as our mortality?
So my commitment is, I think the best way of describing it is that contractually you can have all the paper in the world, and I am tied in. I have a 4-year lock-in. It's now into 3 years left to go. I have, if I leave, because I've already been successful in my life, I'm a high net worth or considered to be. I think actually compared to those in the rich list, I'm not anymore. But I have financial penalties attached to my equity. So rather than having incentivization to earn the equity, it was done in reverse because I had already, obviously I was a buy-in, I had already owned the company. So there's a negative clawback on me. I have to pay back to the company if I leave during that period. But probably bigger than that is, I don't think anyone in my role or an entrepreneur like me goes out to work simply because you've been tied in by a contract or a bit of paper. It's a vocation. And I was very lucky in my career at Brands to have an opportunity to do something different with a business that was very old and out of date. And it was my work that set off the bond that Bernie then did in Formula One and the private equity deals that we then saw with Eddie Jordan did and Williams did and the sales to Benetton and everything else. So here I see a similar thing happening. This is, for me, a vocation. There is going to be huge change in this industry and I would like to lead it. So for me, I'm quite passionate about it and I'm not going anywhere. If I go under the proverbial bus, I have put in place a commercial team beneath me. So my finance director comes from commerce and is extremely commercially savvy. And very soon we will appoint a commercial COO because I need to broaden our horizons to what's next in terms of developing the litigation opportunity. And therefore, I need a commercial COO who we've already identified. So it won't be long before they're in place. So I would like to think your investment is safe. Obviously, would there be an initial knock? Whenever you have a death event like that, but I would like to think the underlying business is secure, and that's certainly how I run it.
I've got a couple of questions. You went through the numbers a bit quickly, and so essentially, how was the treatment of IFRS 15 with these contracts? So I'm looking at it in terms of your earnings are covering the dividend twice at the moment, but then with the working capital build up for the litigation, is the cash backing of those earnings not as good as it perceived? So is the dividend actually covered by cash? And then moving on, it's sort of linked in terms of, I know it's early days, but then obviously if your employees are incentivized by the dividends they get on the equity owned, how do you manage the conflict with them obviously pursuing cases to get those earnings if it's sort of phased in to increase the dividend and obviously taking cases that aren't?
On the latter point, that requires a level of commercial acumen that generally lawyers that I work with don't have, unless they're Ian Rosenblatt or Adrian Harris. So, I mean, you're expecting a commercial ability there that just doesn't, it's not part of their training or discipline. They don't look at life in that way. One of the great things about being a commercial CEO is that they accept me for my track record. And unlike many other law firms where they're looking at a colleague having taken over the firm, they don't see me as a colleague in that sense. So there's an acceptance of my leadership and that I will know better, if you like, in the commercial running of the business. So dividend for them is another bonus in effect, and that's the way that they see it. In terms of the first point, IFRS 15 is all we're accounting for under at the moment because we're not subject to IFRS 9 as yet. We will be, because we will have financial instruments and I can't get around that. And we are in the process of developing an accounting policy at the moment that I hope will be transparent and clear, and it will be available from our interims when we announce our interims. So currently our results to date, the 12.5 million is all IFRS 15. 11.5 million was cash and 1 million was in contracted WIP, which has now been recovered. So it's all got to be contracted. It's all real. Now, going forward, one thing that will happen is that we'll be looking at cash dividend rather than just simply retained earnings. So there'll be cash cover on the dividend. We're not going to pay it out of balance sheet cash. That won't be happening. No.
Yeah. Thank you. Also, excellent presentation. Thank you. A chunk of your business is inherently unforecastable in terms of all you can do, from my experience, is come up with the least bad answer. Mm-hmm. So how are you finding that, given that you've got people in the city and shareholders saying, well, how realistic are your forecasts? Mm-hmm. From my point of view, I used to come up with the lowest number I could possibly come up with that would be satisfactory to the person I was dealing with. So I'm just trying to get to the extent that you can, how are you finding it and how comfortable are you with doing what you're doing?
There's two ways of forecasting, as we all know, bottom up, top down approach. So here, if you're doing bottom up, then it's all from fee earners and what your contracted fee earners are and what your percentage utilizations are and recoveries. And I do that first, I guess, a bottom up approach to see what we're capable of doing. Then I do look back. I'm lucky with Rosenblatt's. I've got 30 years of data. Mm-hmm. So I look back at the last 10 to 12 years and look at what we have been capable of doing. And then I run a line from that. So basically, I'm running the growth line from statistically. What have we done? When it comes to the unpredictability of it, you're quite correct, and it's very difficult because legal cases could come or not come, as the case may be. But I'm used to running a business where if it rained, I dropped 2 million on an event.
Yeah.
So you learn to work with what you've got. And therefore the critical bit is if in the old days, 60% of revenues is dispute resolution, I made sure that 30% were cash pay work. So we would be careful about what we took on risk. Law firms that will go under will be ones that take too much on risk, have not got any balance in the way they run the portfolio, and that then they are not recovering enough in cash.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's an absolutely fabulous presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, all of you. Thank you.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.